This week, we're featuring the second of our four-part series on the church in the public square, and I'm pleased to speak with Susanna Black Roberts. You know, ever since the Apostle Paul told the Romans that the governing authorities were God's servants to whom they should submit, Christians have struggled to understand their relationship to an often antagonistic state. For more than 30 years, Whitehorse Inn and modern Reformation have applied two kingdoms theology, you might call it, to our modern cultural and political arena. But for this series of programs, I wanted to talk to a broad range of thinkers, even those I personally disagree with, to hear in their own words how they understand the relationship of the Christian to politics. So throughout the month of November, the Whitehorse Inn is presenting a four-part series on the church in the public square. And I'll be hosting one-on-one conversations. Be sure to listen each week to get the full cross-section of views I'm interacting with. Susanna is an editor at Mere Orthodoxy, Plow Quarterly, the Davenant Institute's journal Ad Fontes, and Fair Forward. She's founding editor of Solidarity Hall and is on the boards of the Distributist Review, the Davenant Institute, and the Simone Weil Center. Her writing has appeared in First Things, The American Conservative, Plow Magazine, Mere Orthodoxy, and elsewhere. So what should the church do in the public square? In this episode, Susanna advocates for the view of Christian post-liberalism. In her essay, quote, "Our post-liberal moment," Susanna writes that liberalism is a philosophy which sees humans primarily as rights-bearing individuals with no given purpose, whose lives are formed as they seek to realize their own chosen purposes. In opposition to this, she says, quote, "The point of post-liberalism is simply the good in a Christian sense. The purpose of earthly government is to bring those governed to their natural end, to be virtuous men and women with justice in their souls, who participate in the common good of the city. It also has the purpose of directing us to our final supernatural end, according to its own methods, in a humble way and without stepping on the toes of the church." Well, again, while this isn't the view that I subscribe to, I trust you'll appreciate our conversation and be challenged by Susanna's case for post-liberalism. We can all learn valuable things from positions that we don't quite feel in sync with ourselves. We'll be asking the question, what should the church do in the public square? Then people come across a line like this: "The purpose of earthly government is to bring those governed to their natural end, to be virtuous men and women with justice in their souls, who participate in the common good of the city. It also has the purpose of directing us to our final supernatural end, according to its own methods, in a humble way and without stepping on the toes of the church." I've got to say, from my perspective, I've got bells and whistles and alarms going off all over the place.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the Whitehorse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the Whitehorse Inn.
Susanna, we're so grateful you took the time out to be able to give us your take on the relationship of Christ and culture.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
You have a different take than we've heard from. A lot of the others are sort of predictable. It's America, after all. if we were talking about Europe, you'd have all sorts of different parties represented, so many different takes on the political side, much less the relationship of Christ to culture more generally. In America, you know, people have it pretty cleanly divided between left and right. You kind of come in then and mess up everybody's hair.
That's my job.
That's your job, because you come in talking about being post-liberal, and of course you're thinking about something liberal there in a sense that probably most people aren't thinking. Mm-hmm. So why don't we, first of all, out of the gate, how did you come to faith in Christ and give us a little bit of background how this became, relating Christ and culture became an interesting thing for you?
Sure. Well, I was not raised Christian at all. I'm a sort of fourth generation New Yorker. My husband and I live in my great grandparents' house in Queens.
Wow.
Yeah. Although right now, and this is kind of messing everything up further, I'm actually not speaking to you from America, from my normal location of New York City. We're splitting our time between New York and the UK because my husband is English. So I was raised in New York City. My father's Jewish ethnically, though, you know, not really religiously. His parents were Trotskyists. My mom is kind of WASP, but very kind of like non-religiously so. Although my grandfather actually studied with Reinhold Niebuhr at Union and was an ordained minister. He never had a congregation, but he did love to give homilies, and he kind of gave them at every available opportunity, including like the dinner table. But he didn't really raise his kids particularly Christian. They went to church-ish. So I was raised very much, you know, we did Christmas and Hanukkah. At one point, I'd asked to go to Sunday school, and my parents were like, oh, okay, well, so they took me to the Unitarian Church on 80th and Lexington, which is this very, it's a little outpost of Boston in New York. It's like extremely highbrow, ethical culture, society stuff. So that was fun. I had fun at Unitarian Sunday school for a couple of years. My dad read me the C.S. Lewis book, the Narnia books, when I was a kid. And then when I was around 14 or so, 15, 16, and began having the normal existential crises, I have a sense of there being a good. What does that mean? Like, what does ought mean? If I have a feeling of ought, does that correspond to anything? What is the purpose of getting up in the morning? Not that I was like depressed or anything, but like why should I not be an existential nihilist? Which I feel like is kind of a common thing to think about when you're 15. I don't feel like I'm just a material being. Is that an illusion, or like, does God exist? So Dad gave me a bunch of the C.S. Lewis apologetics. He gave me, I think the first one he gave me was Surprised by Joy, actually, which is not, you know, it's his autobiography. And I read this and I was just like, I had no idea there was anyone else whose the inside of his head was like mine. And it just felt like I knew this guy and I knew his experience really well. It was like meeting a brother. It was really intense. I loved it. And it's still probably my favorite of C.S. Lewis's books. But then I read Mere Christianity and The Problem of Pain and all those miracles. And so I decided I wanted to get baptized. Again, totally freaked my parents out. But they were like, all right, well, you can get baptized in your grandfather's church, which was Riverside Church in New York City, which is, again, uptown by Union. It's kind of like the home of the social gospel. I think Harry Emerson Fosdick was a pastor there. It's UCC, so it's United Church of Christ. The joke is that it stands for Unitarians Considering Christ, right, which is pretty much what it was. And, you know, I got baptized. There were preparation classes, but I skipped them. And I had this sense as I was going down into the water, I think God just kind of put this in my head, like, oh, you're getting your sins washed away. And that was like, nobody had ever told me that. Like, sin was, other than in the C.S. Lewis books, this was not a category that, you know, I think I'd ever heard talked about in church, any of the churches that I'd gone to. So I was like, all right, I'm getting my sins washed away. That's good. Like, I feel like my regeneration kind of went into remission is the way that I put it. So I, through college, I was very interested in political philosophy and like and metaphysics, but basically more political philosophy. But I wasn't really going to church. I still thought of myself as a Christian. I still read a bunch of C.S. Lewis, but I was extremely like arm's length from the evangelical group on campus. This was at Amherst. Then in grad school in Cambridge, like a friend randomly invited me to go to the Cambridge Vineyard, which is, you know, the Vineyard is evangelical / charismatic. That particular congregation later went quite flaky, like flakier than it was already being Vineyard. I am very far from that theologically now, but those were the first people who I'd ever met probably in my life who didn't think that Jesus was dead. I just hadn't met Christians before, really. You know, I wasn't friends with any of the evangelicals in college. I don't know what my grandpa believed about Jesus just before he died. We started to get into this like epistolary conversation about it, but he died before we could go further than that. But this was when I really started praying. This is when I sort of experienced the fear of hell, the fear of the Lord in a real fear sense. this is when my conscience like started screaming at me about things. And I was like, I don't even, well, that was fine, you know. And this is really, you know, I said the sinner's prayer a bunch of times. I didn't know what I was doing, you know. And I started trying to follow Jesus. So that was grad school. And it was really disorienting and kind of terrifying. And like at one point I was like, I'm a freaking conservative Christian now. I guess I should go to the South. So my friend Leanna from college, her uncle, whose name was Uncle Janus, it was, you know, J-A-N-U-S, like the God. Uncle Janus was a Southern Baptist pastor in Kentucky, and he was running a vacation Bible school. And I was like, well, I think I should go to Kentucky to be like a counselor at his vacation Bible school as a kind of like shock therapy, or like, I'm a conservative Christian, so I better just bite the bullet.
Jump in the deep end.
Yeah. So I went down. This was like, I guess probably the summer after I really started trying to follow Jesus. I was really worried there wouldn't be coffee. So I took instant espresso with me, like a jar of that, and then a bunch of like Catholic theology. And I like took a deep breath and I went to Kentucky, and it was great. It was so much fun. And the Vacation Bible School curriculum had like, there are all these C.S. Lewis references. And I was like, wow, these people are not what I thought they'd be. And they're a lot more thoughtful about their faith than I thought they'd be. And they're a lot smarter about it. And they know the history. Like, I am not more holy than them. A, I'm a lot less holy than them. And B, I think I disagree with them about some theological stuff. But I also realize that they've been thinking about this for longer than I have. So I did clown ministry briefly.
Wow.
You're kidding. Like, I can't, this is really embarrassing. Yeah, but it was great. At one point I had this conversation with one of the Southern Baptist ladies where I was like, so how come you guys don't drink since like everyone drinks in the Bible? And she's like, it's just our custom. And I was like, oh, okay.
Huh.
It was weird. The other thing that was really funny, which I didn't expect, because I didn't know anything about evangelical culture at all. Like, I had never met an evangelical. This one girl who she was, you know, 9 or something, and I was being her counselor. And she found out that I was half Jewish, and she's like Leah and Rebecca and Rachel. And I was like, yeah.
Oh,
and her eyes
wonderful.
Got really big. It was so sweet. And I was like, oh, she's like, do you wear a headscarf? Because she had like a children's Bible and like all the matriarchs wore headscarves. And I was like, sometimes I wear a headscarf.
Wow.
Yeah.
Isn't that wonderful that that was the connection, not other connections that could have been drawn? I hope you're enjoying this new free extended version of White Horse Inn. It's only made possible by people like you who want to support the work that we do. Please consider partnering with us. Our partners are co-laborers in this important work of reformation. From the pulpit to the pew, from the boardroom to the living room, we need your help to get the gospel right and get the gospel out. For more information, go to whitehorsein.org/partner. It's whitehorsein.org/partner. You call yourself post-liberal.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that if you would.
Sure. There's kind of two different things that people mean by post-liberal. I actually mean it politically primarily, although, you know, theologically, there's this whole camp of post-liberalism, which John Milbank, who's a dear friend, is kind of a big part of, and then there are earlier versions of theological post-liberalism. I primarily mean it politically, which it basically means that I'm not a liberal. So I'm not a liberal in the sense that I'm not a classical liberal. I'm not an 18th century Lockean natural right kind of liberal. But liberalism happened, and there's a lot of good things that are associated with it.
Can we just, for listeners, there may be some listeners who are wondering if you're talking about liberalism the way it's often spoken of in the media and so forth.
Oh, okay. Liberalism is basically the idea that we should think of ourselves primarily as choosing individuals. Like, that is kind of the truest way to understand ourselves. And that our right to choose is basically the most fundamental thing that you can say about us. And that politically, what the state exists to do is to protect that right to choose and kind of create a kind of playing field in which all of these choosing people can, you know, not hurt each other physically, and other than that, kind of leave each other alone. So that's the caricatured version, and it's kind of like the most extreme version. And so that was kind of an idea that was developed starting with Thomas Hobbes, and like a little bit earlier, you can push it, some of the early modern scholastic philosophers who were taking stuff from Thomas and tweaking it in this weird new way. But basically, it was Hobbes, Locke, and then Rousseau took it in this other direction. And then like America is founded as a liberal democracy, as a liberal republic, on the idea primarily that, you know, again, the state exists to create a sphere of action for rights-bearing individuals to make the choices that seem good to them. So it's kind of like, well, that sounds good. Like, what's wrong with that? It's in opposition to kind of basically the whole rest of the political philosophy of Christendom. So it was new when these ideas started to pop up. The people who were proposing them understood themselves to be rejecting earlier ideas. And those earlier ideas find their roots in greatest flourishing, I guess, in Thomas Aquinas. But before that, he was drawing things from Augustine, from Aristotle, from Cicero, primarily from Aristotle, obviously. Although he does cite Augustine more than Aristotle, which is like, whatever, which is something that I feel like Reformed people need to know about Aquinas, just because it might make them feel better about him. This kind of gets to what I was studying in college and, you know, what I was really interested in at Amherst, which was political philosophy. So I studied with a guy called Hadley Arkus, who was actually one of the founders of the magazine First Things. And I think he was like on their, has been on their editorial board maybe since forever. He actually wrote a book called First Things, which the magazine drew its name from. And he's philosophically strange himself. Mm-hmm. He was Jewish. He's since converted to Catholicism. But through him and kind of his philosophical world, I had started reading Plato and Aristotle and all of, you know, sort of the tradition of classical political philosophy. And in that tradition, the purpose of, you are not primarily an individual, you are, man is by nature a political animal. So political in this sense means an animal who lives in cities or a creature who lives in society. So we shouldn't actually understand ourselves primarily as individuals, although we are individuals in a certain sense, but we do primarily exist in relation to each other and in the Thomistic sense in relation to God. And our choosing, our freedom, both the freedom of our wills and our political freedom, is not a good in itself. It's a good because it's like a strength. It's what's called a virtue. But it's good in the way that like the strength of my muscle is good. It can be used to do good or it can be used to do bad. And what it's for, our freedom of will, God gave that freedom of will to us for the purpose of choosing good. In the same way, the political freedoms that we have, we are given them for the purpose of choosing good. We're not given them as a good in themselves. And the purpose of the state is we live together in the state or in a polity in order to pursue what's called the political common good. We can go back to that, but I'll stop there. Just, is there anything that's totally bizarre or confusing or nonsensical?
No. I think it makes great sense to contrast the outlook that for centuries, I mean, you could just say pre-modern versus modern outlook of people as, you know, all cultures, not just Christendom, but as embodied, as social, as mm-hmm. public beings, and mm-hmm. now everything becomes sort of privatized. Mm-hmm. My own inner life becomes more important than our shared life together. Mm-hmm. Voluntarism of modernity becomes so marked.
Yeah. And obviously there are various ways that 17th century liberalism falls down through the centuries and becomes various things. And kind of, I would say that at its, one of its kind of final forms or one of its kind of Pokemon evolutions is existentialism, where like there is no good. What we choose is good. And to a certain degree, good is not the category here. The point is to choose. And so the idea that there is no essence, we don't really have selves. So existence precedes essence and we exist.
No nature or telos.
We don't have natures. We don't have teloi. There's not really any such thing as human nature. Obviously, Simone de Beauvoir takes this is taken up in a lot of feminism with the idea that there's not any such thing as, you know, being a woman. and there's no purpose that is outside us. Like, we decide our own purposes and we decide our own natures. You can really see how that got there from liberalism, from classical liberalism. It does make sense. It is like a radical, you know, insane derivation of it. But I don't actually think that Hobbes would be that surprised. But I think Locke would be shocked by that. I don't think Hobbes would be shocked by that.
So we're basically at the core of our being, not a thinking thing, as Descartes mm-hmm. said, but a choosing thing.
Right.
It doesn't matter what you're choosing, just
right.
the fact that you have that agency that we
yeah.
keep talking about, that
yeah.
agency.
Yeah. And I've had, you know, many, many conversations, usually in person and then on Facebook, in annoying Facebook groups, such that I had to delete Facebook from my phone because it was too irritating. Like, Twitter, I think, is, you know, totally fine. And if anyone wants to talk to me on Twitter, I love that. But Facebook makes me insane. Anyway, I've had many conversations where Christians, you know, I've had this conversation with Christians before, many of whom are very committed to the American political system, to capitalism, to classical liberalism. And I totally understand why that would be attractive to them, partly because classical liberalism in most of its forms, in certainly Lockean liberalism and the liberalism of the founders, has an account of natural law, which is obviously huge. And that's great. That is absolutely wonderful. It's also not something that liberalism invented. That was something that liberalism grabbed, you know, fleeing from Egypt. That was some of the spoils of Egypt that it grabbed from the classical tradition. People, when I have these conversations with them, often will say, well, God gave us free will. I said, yeah, like, God gave us free will, but he's not neutral as to what we do with it. Like, he gave us free will so that we could worship him. You can quibble about various Calvinist things about this, but I'm not talking about that kind of thing. I'm just talking about, like, the freedom to choose. Like, God does actually want willing and delightedly loving worshipers, not like meat robots. Like, it's not just out there as a good in itself. That freedom is like a power that he gave us, the way that he gave us, you know, the ability to think. And it's actually very related to our ability to reason and think. He gave us our immune systems. He gave us our muscles. And he gave us those things in order for us to be able to do good to each other and to worship him.
Free for what? When you say free,
yeah.
What exactly are you saying? And you're right, it transcends even the Calvinist Arminian debate.
It's not really about that.
No, it's really, again, back to teleology, mm-hmm. right? I mean, if you think that you really don't have any purpose, mm-hmm. but you're here on earth to choose your purposes, mm-hmm. then you're not going to really understand this view of freedom.
Yeah.
A dog doesn't have freedom if it can choose between chirping mm-hmm. and
flying
yeah. and so forth. A dog has freedom when it realizes its doggishness.
Yeah.
By barking and running after birds and so forth.
Yeah.
We don't actually have mm-hmm. freedom when we are not fulfilling our chief end.
Yeah. And I mean, I think we can see this really a lot more easily when we think about what it means to live, to make good choices in our lives. Like, if you're addicted to something, even if you're choosing it, but you're not choosing it freely exactly, no one's constraining you, no one's forcing you to like inject heroin or whatever, but you're certainly not being your best self. Like, you're not living, you're not being a flourishing human being. You know, the way that this plays out is it doesn't mean that like you have to be in lockstep all the time. That's actually something that people, I think, worry about, that this is constraining. And it's actually not. What the classical tradition teaches is that you actually need to become free, that you're kind of not necessarily free as a baby. You're not free to walk. You're not free to talk. You don't have those developed powers yet. You're not free to make good choices because you can't reason and you don't have a lot of willpower, you know? But as you grow up, you learn, you gain those powers. You gain the ability to walk, you gain the ability to talk, you gain, you know, the ability to not eat the marshmallow and to like eat it later. You gain the ability to share, you gain the ability to like make art. And all these things are helping you to become free, to be a human being. That's the kind of freedom that the classical tradition teaches we should be aiming for. That's the freedom to be a human being and also the specific human being that we are in the particular place and time that we live.
So what does this mean? To a lot of people, it'll sound like, okay, you're post-liberal. It means you don't like capitalism or democracy or human rights. What are we talking about here? Christian socialism?
Mm-hmm.
Then people come across a line like this. The point of post-liberalism is simply the good in a Christian sense. The purpose of earthly government is to bring those governed to their natural end, to be virtuous men and women with justice in their souls who participate in the common good of the city. It also has the purpose of directing us to our final supernatural end according to its own methods in a humble way and without stepping on the toes of the church. I've got to say, from my perspective, I've got bells and whistles and alarms going off all over the place, and I'm sure that you can sort this out for me.
Sure. Well, okay, so obviously I work for an Anabaptist magazine, and so my Anabaptist colleagues also have bells and whistles and red flags going up when they hear that stuff, although they're fine with the natural end stuff because they're not liberals either.
And I would be fine with a natural end, too. It's just when you put the supernatural end, I go,
Well, we can talk maybe more about the natural end at some point, just because I feel like a lot of your listeners might not even be okay with that. But the supernatural end, there's a couple of different things that I would say. So, you know, one is that one of the purposes of law is to be a teacher, to teach you to be good. I'm not talking about like law is something that kind of acts on us in this weird way. This is not a law and grace thing. This is just sort of like a phenomenology of like what law does. Yes, it does the thing that Paul describes. It also, especially when you're regenerate, it sort of says, go in this direction. It shows you what is orderly and what is good. And that is pointing you towards your supernatural end. Like in as much as the government's laws match natural law, it is already pointing you towards your supernatural end because there's not this harsh, this gets into the sort of like nature grace. There's no such thing as pure nature. So when we're talking about being good human beings, you can't really think about that in isolation from worshiping Jesus Christ. There's not like a kind of good human being that's totally separate from worshiping Jesus. Although there is a distinction between nature and grace, there are virtuous pagans. But in as much as we're like being taught not to murder by the law and being regenerate, having that really kind of speak to us and call us to live in a society where human life is valued. And I think that this can work on unregenerate people too through common grace. That's teaching us to be good subjects in the kingdom of heaven. And I don't see how you can separate those.
Probably what a lot of listeners are wondering at this point is, okay, I'm intrigued by the theory, but bottom line, are you saying that the state has a divine mission to essentially enforce a Christian habitus, a Christian character? We even say here, with justice in their souls, the city, the earthly city, is entrusted with that kind of a task to ensure that we have justice in our soul, which is, I mean, for us, I mean, means sanctified, regenerate.
I think that while, again, this gets at a lot of things, including a mid-century inter-Catholic debate between Henri de Lubac and Garrigou Lagrange, which we won't get into. But like, I just don't think that you can very easily separate what is the job of the state and what is the job of the church. You can say a couple of things. They are distinct. The church and the city have separate roles. But because ideally they're cooperating to help people become good humans, which ultimately means good Christians, they're not at war with each other, certainly. It's not the job of the state to preach the gospel, but there's nothing inappropriate about a state establishing Christianity as a religion. It's on some level unjust for any person in authority, any magistrate, to not ascribe to Jesus, you know, the source of his authority. It's wrong to not give credit where credit's due. It's not just for President Biden to not acknowledge that his authority comes from Jesus. God is the one who put him there. Like, God is the reason that Biden is president. That's where his authority comes from. And it's not just of him not to acknowledge that. And in as much as the U.S. Constitution doesn't permit that or have that, there's a little bit of, you know, more than a little bit of injustice there. It doesn't mean that our Constitution and our laws are unjust in all ways, but in that way, they are unjust. And there's a thousand, you know, questions that this leads to, like, what about religious minorities? You know, does this mean that the state should coerce people into being Christian? And like, obviously not, because you can't and shouldn't coerce people into being Christian. Like, that's not how any of this works. the closest we can get is baptizing babies if you're their parents. You can't even do that if you're not their parents, you know? No, you can't. The state has no right to coerce anyone. The church has no right to coerce anyone into being Christian.
But over most of the centuries where this sort of teleological view of natural law was in place, of course, the church did think, and the state, the whole culture thought that it was something that had to be enforced. It was the state's responsibility, the state's duty to work on the civil mm-hmm. side for that common supernatural end that the church worked on from the liturgical side.
Yeah, that's not the same thing as coercing someone into being Christian. I mean, I think it's important because the value of the individual conscience is so profound in order to preserve the integrity of human beings and the image of God in them. One of the jobs of the state is to actually kind of make sure that people are not coerced into being Christian. But that doesn't mean that it shouldn't do what it can to help the work of the church in presenting the gospel and letting the Holy Spirit do whatever he wants with people.
I guess I'm a little bit more cynical about the historical
side. There's like 100,000 ways. It's almost never been done well.
Lopping off the head of an infidel crying, Christ is Lord. As a, something you're expected to do as a knight,
that strikes
me as coercion. But
yeah, that's not good. It's literally, this has almost never been done well. Very few things have ever been done well.
Isn't that interesting? I think that's a great point that you make, Susanna, because I feel that way about every approach we've talked mm-hmm. about. Every approach, mm-hmm. as different as each is from the others, every approach. Yeah, but you know what? When has this ever worked? I am on the two kingdoms side mm-hmm. of things, right?
Well, so am I, but I think we would understand those differently.
Right, right. You can throw out titles uh-huh. and terms and say, but how do you define it? But Luther and Calvin, let's talk about Luther and the peasant mm-hmm. wars, or what he said about Jews, mm-hmm. or Calvin and the burning of Servetus. Mm-hmm. Or go back to Augustine and his two cities. Mm-hmm. Brilliant. Wonderful. Oh, I want to live. I want to live in his two cities. And yet
there's the Pelagian. There's, the Donatists. Yeah.
When have we ever? But isn't it wonderful to have a religion that's so much better than we are?
Yes. There have been good Christian rulers, but there haven't ever been really, really, really. I mean, like, Jesus is the good Christian ruler. Like, he is the good king. Yeah. We can do our best to be magistrates that in some way approximate his justice and his mercy.
You don't think the secular ruler should baptize or administer communion or preach? Or
not his job.
In light of your view, how would you challenge the church and Christians today with respect to their social and political involvement? What are like the top two or three things that you try to tell people who are just wanting to figure out how their discipleship impinges on their politics?
I guess one of the things that I'd say, and this kind of has to do with a lot of weird sociological stuff in American history following the fundamentalist modernist split, I think. This is not true of all Christians. It's been my perception, and I'm not really an evangelical particularly. I kind of am. I'm an ACNA Anglican, which is fairly evangelical, but I don't really know that much about it. Like, whatever. It's kind of a foreign world to me to a certain degree. But it seems to me that there's this thing that non-mainline Protestants in the U.S. have, which is they're addicted to being either underdogs or to having a kind of like bludgeon-like power. And neither of those is like a particularly responsible way to do politics. And I think it, to a certain degree, has to do with not having had mainstream power. Like, there's plenty of political, power in evangelicalism. It's populist power. It's not power that knows how to actually rule well. And just according to sort of the classical political theories, the ability to rule well comes from ruling yourself and then ruling your household. And then being trained in kind of, appropriate habits of authority. And I think that evangelicals often can rule themselves very well and can rule their households very well. But I don't think they've been trained in habits of political authority in the way that mainline Protestants and kind of post-Protestants have been. I don't think mainline Protestants and post-Protestants are necessarily using that political authority particularly well, but they have often been trained in those habits.
That's a fascinating point. That's really interesting. How much of that is, you know, the Presbyterians, Episcopalians, and at least the Massachusetts Congregationalists, all kind of belonged to a landed gentry?
Yeah, it's a class thing. It's almost entirely a class thing.
Yeah. Had the leisure for liberal education and so forth.
Yeah. It's having the sense of, obviously, you know, being brought up, going to prep schools, you're kind of like inculcated with this like sense of horrible obligation of like, it's your job to fix the world, not in a religious way, but just like, it's not going to be your job to like be a private citizen, like go into business. And you might go into business and make money. You might like join a consulting firm, but that's actually not a very high calling. It's kind of your obligation to seek the good of the city. And that's very much part of, at least when I was going to prep school and, you know, in college and so on, that's like, that was very much built into that.
But today, would you say Amherst or BU or Harvard or Stanford, that the main thing is training people for being able to rule well and to be educators and to pass on and pass down virtue? Or do you think that it's basically training people for exactly what you were talking about there, training people for making a lot of money and, you know, maybe serving neighbor?
Yeah.
But
so Amherst didn't let you do pre-law or pre-med, or certainly there were no business degrees, like, because you were not there to do a pre-professional degree. That's not why you were there. And Amherst still doesn't let people do that. Obviously, plenty of people go into hedge funds like immediately upon graduation. But again, that's like thought to be sleazy. Like, it's not, making money, being a businessman is not particularly highly regarded. I think that to a certain degree, wokeness is a distorted and weirdified version of that sense of obligation to improve the world. I think it's distorted primarily by its own sense of underdogness.
But there's a self-righteousness about it still. That kind of, I'm above you, yeah. And I need to show you the light because you're in darkness. And
yeah, which is the bad version of a kind of sense of authority. Because that tradition is still there, you still have this, like, it's bad to make money. What's really good is to help make the world a better place. And then when that gets put together with all of these, with identity politics and with the sense of we don't have power and we need to grab power, which is, I think, left over from the 60 generation, which never felt comfortable seeing itself as the man, then you get a lot of ugliness. But there's good there too. The civil rights movement was a wonderful example of like mainline Protestants and the Black church ruling really well.
Mm-hmm. And doing what wouldn't have happened otherwise.
Yeah.
What would a post-liberal society look like in your vision? The church doing its thing, fulfilling its role, the state fulfilling its role. And obviously, a culture is pretty nihilistic if it only has the church and the state.
It might not be nihilistic, but it'd be very boring.
Yeah. What would the culture look like in your vision?
I mean, I think none of us are, like, unless you're actually a nihilist or maybe an existentialist, very few of us are liberals in our everyday lives. Most of us have a sense, especially if you're, not just if you're Christian, but like, you know, you have a sense of your family is there for an end. Your family is there to serve God. Your family is there to experience the common good of the family, not the political common good. But still, it's a common good in your life together. In other words, you know, when you gather together and around the table, there's a good there that you're experiencing, the good of being a daughter or being a father. It's a common good in the sense, meaning that you can't just take your own bit off and enjoy it by yourself. You need to be in those relationships in order to experience it. And I think a post-liberal culture would just have a lot more and honor a lot more of those experiences of common good, including, you know, the political common good, meaning living together in justice and friendship, but just on an everyday level, you know, in all kinds of different, you know, little platoons or whatever you want to say, just having lots and lots of experiences of the kinds of goods that you can only experience with other people. And also noticing and experiencing different kinds of excellence in your life, learning to rule yourself, developing virtuous abilities, you know, learning to play the piano. These are things that, it's just living a flourishing human life is what this is about. You know, we can talk about tyranny at some point if you want to, because this is not about like knuckling under to tyranny. This is about living lives as human beings and living them well.
Flourishing together.
Yeah.
Susanna Black Roberts, we are grateful that you took the time to discuss these issues with us. Very important matters. The critique of liberalism, the critique of human beings merely as choosers who have no end other than to choose every day, 24 hours a day. We appreciate very much the time you've taken to give us your wisdom. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's all the time we had for this new extended episode of White Horse Inn. I'm so glad we're able to provide this episode, our entire archive for that matter, more than 30 years of weekly conversations for free to our global audience. You can be a part of that work by signing up to become a partner today. Our partners are essential to the work of White Horse Inn and Sola Media. They produce the Core Christianity and White Horse Inn broadcasts, publish Modern Reformation magazine, and gather scholars around the world for our Theo Global seminars. Our partners carry the work of Sola Media to every country on earth. From the pulpit to the pew, from the boardroom to the living room, we need your help to get the gospel right and to get the gospel out. For more information, go to whitehorsein.org/partner. It's whitehorsein.org/partner. Thanks again, and be sure to join us next time on White Horse Inn, where we'll be talking with Gary DeMar, president of American Vision. It's next time on White Horse Inn.